What I want to show you is that the addition of sex to Title VII was not only meant to destroy the bill, but to fundamentally divest black people who had fought for civil rights in the United States of any economic or educational opportunities and give them to white women. Today, I want to talk to you about liberalism and intersectionality. And this is going to be somewhat of a provocative talk, because I know how people in the UK like their terms that they import from America. They're shiny, they're pretty. But what I want to show you is they're actually a little dirty. They have these horrible, horrible histories that I don't think many people know about. And I want to talk to you about it because there's a fundamental stake in how we conceptualize equality, liberty, and what we even see as the success of the civil rights movement, which I think you can see is being decimated in America right now. So let's start off with what we think of liberalism as an idea. Okay, what do we mean when we talk about liberalism? So generally, we're speaking about a political and a moral philosophy that's emphasizing individual freedom, equality before the law, limits of government, and is grounded in the protection of civil rights and liberties. Now, this takes root in Enlightenment thought, those of you who may like Locke or other social contract theorists, right? It's where governments get a certain kind of legitimacy from the security and safety of individuals, and exists primarily to safeguard fundamental rights. In our contemporary times, we kind of think of political liberalism as the foundation of representative democracies, the basis of the rule of law, and it gives us kind of protections, right, and prevents unjust expansions against civil rights like safe violence and individual incursions upon our own safety. But what's most important about liberalism as a political philosophy is that it insists that societal change is rational and peaceful, because it's a democratic sensibility that actually promotes an ever-expanding racial inclusiveness. Now, one of the reasons that liberalism becomes so dominant as a political theory isn't because it won the marketplace of ideas, so to speak, but it's become the ongoing dogma of political philosophy within Anglo-Saxon traditions. Our Anglophone traditions, see? Slip up there. So it's a philosophy that's generally conducted in light of perceived triumph, right? And if you disagree with liberalism, you're considered to be a radical, irrational, if not pathological, for not believing in the success of Western ideas to kind of triumph and bring us to an era of democratic freedom. But let me tell you a different side of this. In the United States, after the Civil Rights Movement and the Vietnam War, liberalism was not the intuitive solution to the problem. In fact, there were reports written, like the Harvard Core Curriculum Report in 79, that insisted that if we wanted to prevent another civil rights movement and the kind of disorder that was caused by student groups rising up and protesting American imperialism and the structures of racism, which many black power advocates believe were the seeds of fascism. I think we can now all say they're right under the reign of Trump, right? Spano suggested that we switch to disinterested theories, that we did two things. We demonized the radicality of black militancy. And then we simultaneously moved to postmodernism and post-structuralism as the way to gain distance from political problems. Now, as I argue, Henry Roosevelt's report on the core curriculum, which he began in 1978, actually changed what we thought of as an educated person. It defined liberal arts curricula around the idea that an educated person would be someone who could not only think clearly and effectively, but someone who believed in the universal humanist principles of Western civilization. Said differently, if you're from America, you know that in universities there's this thing called the core curricula. It's what every student has to take to get a degree. That core curricula was instituted to prevent another uprising, specifically a black militancy, but against the state. It allowed all educated people who majored in liberal arts or even STEM to fundamentally believe that Western civilization, liberalism, and humanism were in fact the way forward. But this runs against the current of history. We know that the idea of a peaceful civil rights movement winning out against, winning the hearts and minds of the white public in America is largely illusion. It's a lie. Right from Robert F. Williams, Negroes with Guns, and his wife Mabel Williams, right to Cobb's book on the nonviolent stuff will get killed, or we'll shoot back talking about how black people in the South armed themselves against white terrorism to protect civil rights, to protect non-peaceful or peaceful protesters, right? It was also the militancy of the black community that were largely led by poor working class black men that allowed the civil rights movement to triumph. And this is an important moment and point, because the challenge to American democratic liberal theory was not simply a rational debate. It was a political contestation between poor black people who were disenfranchised, deprived of rights, right, and white liberal academics and white racist institutions. So from this, right, these debates of young people through the South, you got an idea of black power. And we hear about this all the time, but we don't often understand what it actually is. So Stokely Carmichael, or Kwame Ture, as he's known, and Charles Hamilton Houston, or Charles Hamilton, wrote a book called Black Power, The Politics of Liberation. And in that book, they make a very key distinction about what they think enables black people to progress and to get liberty and freedom in the United States. Hence, it wasn't coalitions with white people. So they say, there's a strongly held view in the society that the best, indeed, perhaps the only way for black people to win their political and economic rights is by forming coalitions with liberal, labor, church, and other kinds of sympathetic organization or forces, including the liberal left wing of the Democratic Party. With such allies, they can influence national legislation and national social patterns. Racism could thus be ended. This school sees the Black Power movement as basically being separatist and unwilling to actually enter into these alliances with these white groups. Black Power intellectuals advanced three primary reasons that coalitions with white liberals did not work. The first was that in the context of present-day America, the interests of black people are thought to be identical with the interests of certain liberal groups, labor, and other reformists. The second myth is a fallacious assumption that a viable coalition can be effective between the politically and economically secure and then the politically and economically insecure. So what Ture was pointing out was that you assume that you can work with white liberal organizations, but they have power and economic security. You have no power and none. And lastly, the third myth assumes that political coalitions are and can be sustained on a moral, friendly, and sentimental basis by appeals to one's consciousness. Now, you'll find that most black intellectuals during this period of time, even Martin Luther King, did not agree that conscience and morality were fundamentally the best ways to proceed. In his last book, King was very suspicious of this idea, saying that white America was in fact schizophrenic. But black power advocates and theorists said that the only way forward was for black people to actually have political and economic independence. Now, why is this important for our theories of liberalism? Well, as a political philosophy, black power held the hearts and minds of black people. It captured the imaginations of groups of people as far away as Asia and Cuba. But for American democracy to claim that it had won and the civil rights movement was successful, it had to be destroyed because it was incompatible with liberal democratic theory. So it placed racism, because black power placed racism at the center of America's democratic ethos, this meant that race had to be problematized as an organizational concept to the black public. They had given their hearts and minds to this idea that they could determine their own political and economic futures. Had to destroy that. And a more efficacious organizational concept, such as gender or sex, had to emerge to take its place. We begin intersectionality, or we begin to engage intersectionality, as a reflection of Title VII. So most of you heard the term, you've probably read Kimberly Crenshaw, or at least watch YouTube videos of her, okay? And you know, she starts with Title VII, this question of a protected class, race, sex, national origin, how these different identities are necessary to better understand the individual, if not the very structures of society. Well, what I want to show you is that the addition of sex to Title VII was not only meant to destroy the bill, but to fundamentally divest black people who had fought for civil rights in the United States of any economic or educational opportunities and give them to white women. This is Congressional Record 2854 from 1964. I want you to read what the actual debates in Congress on this bill was actually about. Martha Griffiths begins addressing the chairman, saying, "I rise in support of this amendment offered by the gentleman from Virginia, Mr. Smith. Unless this amendment is adopted, amendment to add sex to Title VII, the white women of this country would be drastically discriminated against in favor of a Negro woman. If a white woman and a Negro woman apply for the same job, and each woman had identical qualifications, The chances are about 99-1 that the Negro woman would be given the job, because if the employer did not give the job to the Negro woman, he could be prosecuted under this bill. Failure to employ the white woman would not subject the employer to such actions. Common sense tells us that the employer would hire the Negro woman to avoid prosecution. The white woman will be at a great disadvantage in the business world unless this amendment is adopted. And it gets better. So Title VII legislation allowed white feminists and white women to trade off protections between what was supposed to be allocated to the black race and who they perceived were a threat to their economic and political future, which were black women in this case, and led to the divestment and disadvantage of black men. But they did this all under the cover of anti-discrimination law. I want you to hear what Emma Guffey Miller, who is the national chairwoman of the National Women's Party, said. She says, "We are alarmed over the interpretation that may be given to the words discrimination on the account of race, color, religion, and national origin used in the bill, if the meaning of these words is not made clear in the bill itself. We are informed that in the past, some government officials have interpreted race, color, religion, and national origin in a way that has discriminated against the white, native-born American woman of Christian religion. I share the views of my colleague from Oregon in her desire to eliminate the proven discrimination which colored women may have suffered, but at the same time, I feel it is only just and fair to give all women protection against discrimination," end quote. Now, the reason I love this bill is because it fundamentally changes how we think debates over Title VII and civil rights happened. Martha Griffith is clear, and the debates in this, the rest of the bill are clear as well. You had white feminist organizations writing in saying, black people don't deserve these rights because they will be advantaged over white women. And we surely can't let that happen.
To continue watching this video, click the link in the top left or in the description below.
With a free trial, you can enjoy the full talk and thousands more.
Thank you for being part of the conversation.